Good afternoon and welcome to the March meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine in Northport, Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, our president, who is playing hooky today in Florida. I don't know why, but he is. Founded in 1983, the Forum is now celebrating into its 31st year, almost 31 years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and the U.S. Diplomatic policy and often the lack thereof. This is, I calculated this, the 387th meeting of the Forum. Sarah told me before she left, playing hooky herself, that we have never missed a month without some sort of a program. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. We're delighted to have today Yossi Alfer, a return speaker. Yossi has been here three times, once for the Camden Conference. This is his second time for the Midcoast Forum, four times altogether. Four. Oh, my goodness. He has a long history of his early history was working in military intelligence, 12 years of service in the Mossad, and in 1995 he was director of the Yafi Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, and served in July 2000 as special advisor to the Prime Minister of Israel during the Camp David talks. Starting in 2001, he formed an organization called Bitter Lemons with a Palestinian colleague, Ghassan Khatib, who's director of Palestinian Authority's Government Media Center and a professor at Birzeit University. Bitter Lemons was a very ambitious attempt to keep the dialogue going between Israelis and Palestinians. The story of Bitter Lemons is much like the story of the Israel-Palestine peace process. It has more bumps in the road than road sometimes. But anyway, Yossi, come tell us about it. Yossi Alfer.
Thank you, Tom, and good afternoon, everybody. As Tom was corrected, this is my fourth appearance in your neighborhood, including one at the Camden Conference. I'm not a glutton for punishment. I really enjoy speaking to you folks. I think you're a terrific audience, and I know you're going to needle me with some good questions. Now, you have to hear my first semi-disclaimer. In the past, I've spoken mainly about the Palestinian issue and what's going on right now. Today, I'm telling you about my book, and my book tells you about very different dimensions of Israel's existence and strategic behavior in the Middle East. It has nothing to do with the Palestinian issue. And the first message I want to transmit to you, by virtue of talking about the book, is that a great deal of what Israel does in the Middle East has nothing to do with the Palestinian issue. There are other wars, there are other challenges, there are other countries to make peace with, Islamist movements challenging Israel and need to find friends and oppose foes at great distances. I'll end up with the Palestinian issue, and I'll end up linking the strategic history I'm telling you about, which goes back to the early 1950s, I'll end up linking it with a number of very current issues, Iran, Palestinian issue, the Islamic State, what's happening in Yemen. But we have to go back and begin much earlier first. What I hope to convey to you by the time I'm finished is wow, there's so much going on that has nothing to do with the Palestinian issue. Everything interacts, of course, but this is a much bigger story than the one we're hearing on a day-to-day basis. We're in the mid-1950s. Israel, having been created in 1948, having fought two wars already, its War of Independence and the 1956 Sinai campaign, Israel is painfully isolated, without friends, without money, surrounded by a hostile Arab world, led by Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser, which calls for its destruction. Constantly, Nasser's radio, Saut al-Arab, is constantly calling to throw the Jews into the sea. This is the atmosphere, attacks all along the borders, two wars behind us, another one inevitable. And the question is, how do we deal with this from this position of total isolation? Well, we had then, and I emphasize then, a leader who really thought strategically, David Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion and his aides in the 1950s came up with four grand strategies. There's no alternative but to call them grand strategies because they encompassed, they were carried out over time, over decades. They had a huge geographical span, and they, to carry them out, Israel had to muster many of its resources. He came up with four grand strategies to deal with Israel's isolation. One was to find a great power partner or patron or protector or ally. Today it's the United States, as Prime Minister Netanyahu illustrated so eloquently in the Congress. That's meant cynically. You'll get that from me as I go along. Today it's the United States, but going back then, it was first Great Britain and then France, and at this time it was France, which was selling Israel weapons, which was cooperating with Israel because of its own problems in Algeria, where the Algerian rebels were being held by the same Egyptians who were opposing Israel. And France was helping Israel with a second grand strategy, and that was to create a nuclear deterrent. Grand strategy number two, which had not yet reached fruition. Grand strategy number three was mass ingathering of the exiles, of the Jewish people, mass immigration, what we call aliyah, in order to give Israel a kind of critical demographic mass, because the state of Israel begins its journey in 1948 with 600,000 people. And it is absorbing hundreds of thousands every year during these years at great expense in order to reach some sort of critical mass. The fourth grand strategy is the one we're talking about, and it was generally called the periphery doctrine. And the idea was, we're surrounded by hostile Arabs. We, in an Israelocentric sense, see ourselves at the center. If you look at an Israeli map, Israel's at the center. If you look at an American map, America's in the center. We all do this. We look at what we call the periphery of the Middle East, beyond the surrounding Arab states. We looked for friends there among the countries bordering on the Arab world from the other side. We're right in the center of the Arab world. Bordering from the other side, countries that shared our concern over Nasser's very aggressive Arab nationalism. This is an era when Islamism is never mentioned. It's all about secular Arab nationalism, and Nasser is the spearhead. So we looked beyond the core, the hostile core, to what we called the periphery, and there we looked for friends and allies, people who would make common cause with us because they shared the same fear, not because they loved us, but because they shared the same concerns, and maybe here and there we had something to offer them. The original periphery concept, as it emerged in 1957-58, put us into two triangular relationships. The northern triangle linked Israel with Turkey and Iran. The southern triangle linked Israel with Sudan and Ethiopia. It's remarkably symmetrical, looks kind of neat. Didn't last very long, because Sudan, which got its independence from Britain in 1956, by 1958 had decided it didn't want to have anything to do with us. And so we were left with the Southern Triangle, just with Ethiopia. But the Northern Triangle lasted over 20 years. It very quickly emerged into a kind of informal alliance. There were never ever any treaty documents that could be framed and put somewhere in a headquarters, but we call this a trident. We call this triangular alliance with Turkey and Iran. That was the name we shared for it. We had a different name in Hebrew. And it involved primarily clandestine intelligence cooperation against Iraq and Syria, and to some extent against the Soviet Union. This was the era of NATO, CETO, CENTO, one of the first things Ben-Gurion did when we created Trident was to write to Eisenhower and Dulles and say, hey, we have an anti-Soviet alliance too. Won't you support it? So he put them in the picture. And this is a constant aspect of many of these periphery operations, was that we looked to market them in order to aggrandize our value in the eyes of whatever foreign powers we were interested in bringing into a close relationship. And Ben-Gurion, from the very beginning, set his sights on the United States. It wasn't a strategic relationship that could reach fruition until after the 1967 war. In the meantime, it was France. But this is the original periphery concept, and the Turkey-Iran-Israel trident relationship was a fairly successful one. Second aspect of the periphery doctrine was the southern periphery, whereby Israel looked for to develop strategic relations or carry out strategic operations in a number of countries bordering the Arab world from the south. Ethiopia, I already mentioned, but you've followed that South Sudan became independent a few years ago. The Southern Sudanese rebellion against the Arab government in Khartoum began with Israeli military help. And this was a completely clandestine operation that involved an Israeli military delegation I don't know if you can you see that red dot?
Yeah
okay. Right along the Ugandan Southern Sudanese border. From the Israeli standpoint, it was both an opportunity to help another non-Arab ethnic group that was subject to Arab aggression, and in the case of the Southern Sudanese, horrible slavery, essentially, visited upon them by the Arab North, and by the by, a way to pin down Sudanese troops that might otherwise find their way via Egypt to the front with Israel. The Yemen operation, I think, is worthy of particular mention because things are happening in Yemen today, if you're following, and nothing seems to change, and everything seems to change. But this is a fascinating operation, and it was the most successful, in my view, periphery operation of them all. We were approached in the early 60s by British veterans of the Strategic Air Service, the SAS, which had been kind of like the Navy SEALs in World War II, or a precursor of them, if you like. And these guys were still looking for adventure, go back still into the 1960s. And they undertook to recruit Israeli help for the royalists in Yemen. Now, the royalists, we're looking at this part of Yemen here, not the south. Southern Yemen was then called Aden, and it was under British rule. This was before the British withdrew from east of Suez. But in northern Yemen, what had for hundreds of years been under the rule of a royal family, we would today call them Houthis. Zaidi Muslims, the Zaidis are close to Shiite Islam, but this was the royal family of Yemen, and they found themselves in a war with so-called Republicans who had revolted with Nasser's connivance and with the Soviets behind them, had led a revolt against royalist rule, and Nasser had sent an expeditionary force of as many as 60,000 Egyptian troops to get rid of the royalists, and he was hoping in this way to push into Saudi Arabia and get his hands on the oil, which would have really given him a very firm grip on the Middle East. And the Soviets were helping, including with their own air force, doing bombing missions. So the British informally asked us if we could parachute in supplies to the royalists. And we're talking about dropping supplies to valleys that are 10,000 feet up in the very high mountains of northern Yemen, an extremely primitive place then as now. We, in the course of 3 or 4 years, we had 14 stratocruiser trips, round trip, 14 hours back and forth to drop these supplies in. Yours truly, as a lowly first lieutenant in Israeli Army Intelligence, was given jobs like making sure there are no Hebrew markings on the booty, the ammunition, which was all booty from previous wars, but that there were no Hebrew markings on it before we parachuted it in. This aid enabled the royalists to hang in there, essentially, to wage this war to a standstill. And then along came the Six-Day War of June 1967, and 30,000 of Nasser's troops were still stuck here. Those who fought us in Sinai, when we interrogated those who fell into captivity, we discovered that they had been thoroughly demoralized by the war in Yemen and worn down, and that this very minor effort of dropping stuff we couldn't use anyway to the royalists here had made a genuine difference in the Six-Day War, and one that no one was allowed to publicize more or less until now. Though this was an extremely successful operation, the Yemenis didn't know where the stuff was coming from. A few Saudis knew. Today they know. Oman, the relationship goes back also to the 1960s and actually continues to this day. One other important relationship with Morocco just won't fit on the map, I'm afraid. We move from here to the question of an ethnic periphery. I mentioned South Sudan already, which I include in the southern periphery. In some ways more significantly, Israel has a history going back to the pre-state period, what's called the Yishuv period, prior to 1948, during the 30s and 40s of the previous century, a history of contacts with the non-Arab or non-Muslim minorities of the Levant. Today you're fairly familiar with the names of quite a few of them. The Kurds in northern Iraq, the Maronites, also very significantly the Druze, who are particularly concentrated at Jabal Druze about here, just north of the Jordan-Syria border. Israel has its own a very significant Druze community. These peoples, whereas Israel reached out on its own to Turkey and Iran and said, hey, let's cooperate, these peoples have traditionally come to us. And anyone who works at an Israeli embassy in Europe or has for the last 60 years can tell you stories of all kinds of Middle East minorities walking in like Copts from Egypt or Kabyles, Berbers from northern Africa, walking in and saying, hey, the Arabs are oppressing us too. Will you help us? Well, I list in the book a whole set of criteria I worked out for when it was possible and when it seemed worthwhile to make common cause with these minorities. But the contacts really go back a long, almost 100 years. And the two most significant operations were our support for the Kurdish rebellion against Iraq, going back to the 1960s, ended in 1975, something for which the Kurds remain very thankful and maintain a very warm attitude toward us, as do the southern Sudanese, by the way. When it comes to minorities, there's compassion and gratitude in both directions. Everywhere else, it's just politics, and usually cynical politics. The Maronites is another story. Most of you, I think, remember the 1982 Lebanon War, where the U.S. ended up landing Marines and suffering significant casualties. From the Israeli standpoint, this was an adventure gone awry completely. In this case, we placed our trust in what seemed to be the allegiance of a fellow minority. The Maronites are Christians, Arabic-speaking Christians. And from the Israeli standpoint, they simply betrayed that trust completely. And we ended up stuck in Lebanon until we withdrew unilaterally 2000. And that account is obviously still open with everything that's happening in the Levant. It's interesting to note that since this fiasco with the Maronites, it was a fiasco for the United States as well, and for the CIA as well. But since this fiasco, Israel has not engaged in any close relationship with another Middle East minority. Our fingers were badly burned, and there is absolutely no likelihood, no matter what goes on here in the Levant, that you're going to see Israeli boots on the ground helping a minority in some place, because we were so badly burned by this experience. Now, profit and loss assessment of, well, let me first end the periphery process. The periphery doctrine essentially ground to a halt in the years between late 77 and early 82. Late 77, Sadat comes to Israel to make peace. And the moment there's an opening for peace with the core, with the Arab core, the periphery fades into relative insignificance. Peace with Egypt or any of our surrounding Arab countries is simply 100 or 1,000 times more important strategically than a relationship with Iran and Turkey, however much we gained from it. It's important to note that when Sadat wanted to begin a peace process with us and needed to send us signals, he sent them via the periphery. He sent them via the Shah in Iran, and he sent them via King Hassan in Morocco, because he knew we had these periphery relationships. And this is also by way of saying the periphery was not directed against peace with our Arab neighbors. It was directed to deter our Arab neighbors by showing them that we had powerful and influential friends, that we had friends at all elsewhere in the Middle East that they would have to reckon with. So when Sadat wanted to start making peace, he came to the King of Morocco, he came to the Shah, he said, send messages to the Israelis. And in fact, Sadat's peace initiative was really cooked in Morocco in high-level meetings that the King of Morocco hosted. So Sadat and peace with Egypt were one factor dwarfing the significance of the periphery. A second factor was the fiasco with the Maronites, which burnt our fingers with regard to minorities. A third was 1979, the Khomeini Islamist takeover of Iran, the fall of the Shah. The minute the Shah was gone and his security services were gone, Trident ended. It simply ended. Our relationship continued with the Turks off and on, right up to almost to the present. Erdogan's Islamist take on Turkish democracy has been a major damper on Israeli-Turkish strategic cooperation in recent years, but there are still fairly close ties between the countries. In Ethiopia, down here off this map, Haile Selassie, who had spearheaded the relationship with Israel, was also removed from power and assassinated in the mid-1970s. So all this came together to bring us into a new era. Late 70s, early 80s, beginning with the peace process in Egypt, an era of growing contact between Israel and its Arab surroundings. You get then to the Madrid process, to Oslo, to peace with Jordan. And you also hear, for the first time, the Palestinian issue takes front and center as the core issue of Israeli-Arab relations. Because until now, that was simply not the case. You may recall that until 1967, the Gaza Strip, where Hamas is today, the Gaza Strip was under Egyptian rule. The West Bank was part of Jordan. So there was no issue of a Palestinian state. There was no PLO. This was simply not on Israel's strategic radar, on the strategic radar of anyone else. We come up to the present, and one more interesting map. If we jump to the present, we encounter an Israel which, over the last few decades, has emerged as a post-industrial economy with close ties with Russia, with China, with India. There's no question of geographic or geostrategic isolation. But we do encounter, first in Iran since 1979, but more recently in the last few years of Arab revolution, as many of the Arab countries surrounding us have become dysfunctional, have collapsed. Islamist movements have moved to the fore, including for 1 year in Egypt under Muslim Brotherhood rule. We encounter a growing sense in Israel that we're being surrounded by militant Islam. Militant Islam, again, for 1 year in Egypt, militant Islam in Iran. I don't think that needs much explaining. Militant Islam in the form of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and the Islamic State in Iraq, Syria, right down to to the Syrian border with Israel, claiming allegiance from the Islamists in Sinai, from the Islamists in Syria, just yesterday from Boko Haram in Nigeria. And then you have Turkey, which under Erdogan has, particularly since the Mavi Marmara incident, you may remember, May 2010, Turkey, which increasingly takes a militant Islamist approach in its foreign policy, pretty much akin to that of the Muslim Brotherhood, which puts it also at odds with our Arab neighbors. So you have a new this sense, but note the question mark on the headline here. You have the sense that conceivably we're being surrounded by a new core, a new militant Islamist core. And yet at the same time, it doesn't sit on the same geographical axis as Nasser and militant Arab nationalism did back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But there are those in Israel who then sit down with the map and who have been very active in promoting relations with Cyprus, Greece, and Bulgaria to send a kind of message to Turkey, we have friends on your flank. Azerbaijan, the same message to Iran. The countries south of Egypt and Sudan, with particular relevance to Iranian smuggling of weaponry to militant Islamists via the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, and to the regime in Sudan, which is pretty close to the Islamist camp as well. Now, at the same time, those of you who love to hear our eloquent prime minister speak may have heard him at the UN back in the fall when he proclaimed that in view of all these threats, that is ISIS here and Iran here, in view of all these threats, Israel has a kind of alliance with Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates. It was an interesting statement. It was a daring statement, I dare say. What was particularly interesting is that none of the leaderships of these countries actually contradicted him. There is clandestine and not so clandestine cooperation. We have diplomatic relations with Egypt and Jordan. Cooperation focusing on the sense of a shared threat from militant Islam, whether Shiite, Iran, and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, or Sunni, the Islamic State, here, you can go practically all over the map. At the same time, this is not an alliance of any formal sort, and all of these countries hasten to add that there can't be anything more overt as long as Israel doesn't deal effectively with the Palestinian issue. But you have here two concepts of a regional alliances of sort, very tentative ones, that may or may not work. I don't think Turkey is particularly concerned that we have a joint naval exercise with Greece. Greece and Cyprus are broke. They're infinitesimally small compared to Turkey, which is a major power with 80 million people. I don't think the Iranians are quaking in their boots to know that we're sitting here in Azerbaijan. But there are people in Israel who think differently and who think that this is an effective new periphery, if you like. Israeli cooperation with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan can only go so far before it runs into the barrier of the Palestinian issue. Now, just a quick aside to note, I mentioned earlier how Ben-Gurion hastened to inform Eisenhower and Dulles of the Trident relationship. Off and on, quite a few of these periphery operations, which were all clandestine, but quite a few of them were known to the CIA or were made known by us to the CIA. One objective was money. The CIA, I remember one of my first jobs in the Mossad was to draft a proposal that the CIA continue to finance our presence in Iraqi Kurdistan, because it served American interests as well. An early present of the CIA to Israel was to reward Trident, Israel, Iran, and Turkey, to build a headquarters in Tel Aviv, like you have NATO headquarters in Brussels, right? So we're going to have Trident headquarters in Tel Aviv. And they built it. And you walked into the building, you turned left for Turkey, you turned right for Iran. The only problem was that the Trident Alliance barely met every half year, and it rotated between the three countries. So this building saw use once every year and a half. And of course, the other problem was the Trident relationship from the Israeli standpoint, in terms of good, usable intelligence, it was practically worthless. We gave them good intelligence. This is how we see it. We didn't get much from them. And they very much compartmentalized Trident. So it's impossible to find a Turk today who's not in jail, whom Erdogan hasn't thrown in jail, who even remembers there was such an alliance. Well, that building first became the training facility from the Mossad, where yours truly went through courses, and is now part of the Mossad campus. But very few people know it was built by the CIA. So there was an American aspect. There were operations the Americans didn't know about, or if they knew about, they objected to. Israel working with the British in Yemen, at that time the U.S. was courting Nasser, wanting to build the Aswan Dam instead of Russia. And so we never told them, whether they knew about it or not, they probably did, but we never told them about it because we knew that they would disapprove of it. But there was this constant give and take and close relationship. And a second interesting aspect is the Jewish aspect, because here and there, the periphery doctrine interacted with that other grand strategy of ingathering of the exiles. So the relationship with Morocco went hand in glove with the immigration to Israel of upwards of 400,000 Moroccan Jews, one of whom is now chief of staff of the IDF. The relationship with Ethiopia went hand in glove with the immigration of Ethiopian Jewry to Israel. The Kurds in northern Iraq, most Iraqi Jews came to Israel in 1950-51, they moved by land into Iran and flew from there. This was before the Trident relationship. But those who stayed and then wanted to come would make their way to, in the summer, when there wasn't too much snow around, to northern Iraq, make themselves known to the Kurds would transfer them into Iran and they would come to Israel. The Kurds provided this, among many services, they provided this service of helping Iraqi Jewry reach Israel. So there was a Jewish aspect as well. To summarize, if you like, a cost-benefit analysis of the periphery doctrine, I would say all in all, it was a success. On balance, it was a success. But it was a success in the sense that it sent this deterrent message to our Arab neighbors. If you like, the most significant deterrent message it sent came from way down here in South Sudan and Ethiopia, the source of the White Nile and the source of the Blue Nile. And the Nile, I'm sure you know, is the lifeblood of Egypt. Without it, Egypt simply has no existence whatsoever. And so there's a huge, understandable paranoia among Egyptians and always has been with regard to anybody conceivably meddling with the sources of the Nile. Well, the Egyptians knew we were here, and we wanted them to know we were here. We wanted them to know we're sitting on the sources of the Nile. We never touched the Nile. From an engineering standpoint, it's practically impossible to divert the waters of the Nile. We never touched anything, but that didn't calm their paranoia that Israel is somehow going to divert the flow of water there. This sent a very powerful message at a time of war. We're sitting in your rear, and we've got our hand on the spigot. In my view, it was a message that helped usher in the peace, because Egyptians had to conclude, okay, we can't beat these guys. We can't throw them into the sea. We're going to have to come to terms with them. But it's interesting, when you look at the notion of a new periphery today, this still worries the Egyptians. The Ethiopians are building something called the Grand Renaissance Dam about here, with Italian and Chinese help. There's absolutely no Israeli involvement. But if you listen to Egyptians and you read the Egyptian press, this is a new Israeli plot. Even though we're at peace, even though we have military cooperation against militant Islamists, some of them are saying, the Israelis are at it again. In my view, this is on the plus side of what the periphery doctrine accomplished. There were areas in which it failed. To the extent that that Israeli strategic planners believed that the Trident, how did I get here? Sorry. That the Trident Alliance guaranteed us military allies when the next war came, there was huge disappointment in Israel, because neither Moroccans, nor Iranians, nor Kurds lifted a finger to help us in 1967 or 1973. And in 67 and 73, we had to deal with an Iraqi expeditionary force of a couple of divisions that made its way through Syria or through Jordan to the front and fought. In 1973, the Moroccans sent a couple of brigades to the Golan front as well. Our erstwhile periphery allies, when the chips were down, they felt they had to contribute. I promised someone a word about Kissinger. In 73, when we expected that Mullah Mustafa Barzani, the leader of the Kurds, would at least muster forces and deploy them so that to pin down Iraqi forces, so that they couldn't make their way to the front, he got a message from Kissinger via the Shah. Shah got a message. Barzani got a message. Don't help the Israelis. This is the early phases of the Yom Kippur War, when we had our backs to the wall and when it could have made a significant contribution. And the Shah joined the oil embargo. And yet, when the wars were over and the dust cleared, we felt we had no choice but to continue with these relationships because they did provide some sort of benefit for us. So let me sum up. As you can see, this is a story about Israel and the Middle East, essentially without Palestinians. It was, on balance, successful. It was one of four grand strategies created by a man who, as I went and researched what he wrote in his diaries about this back in the mid-50s, you have to conclude he was a strategic genius to come up with these grand strategies. Try to think of another country that has grand strategies and has so many, come up with so many in order to survive, and that basically have worked and succeeded over the years. This brings me to a set of comments on the present. One, we don't have leaders who think in brilliant grand strategies today. I dare say that's true of many places in the world, but unfortunately, it's true of Israel. I say unfortunately because we're still in a situation where we need this, kind of thinking. Secondly, referring to the Palestinian issue, the way things are moving, we are moving little by little into a kind of one-state situation with the Palestinians, which will either mean a binational state, the end of a Jewish Zionist state, or some sort of apartheid state. In either case, this will not be an Israel that can easily make common cause with its neighbors in some sort of new periphery doctrine or with its Arab neighbors. And eventually, it will become like any other Arab country, and it won't need strategies like this because it will behave like everyone else in the region. But in the meantime, the whole periphery concept suggests a number of interesting links to the present, and with this I conclude. One is with regard to the Levant minorities, who are increasingly beleaguered by the Islamic State, and if they haven't already, are likely to come to us and look for aid. I'm thinking particularly of the Kurds, of the Druze here, who have a powerful lobby inside Israel and Israeli politics and in the army. And there will be pressures in Israel to come to their aid. And the notion of moving into Syria to aid the Druze goes, there was strategic planning for it back in 1948. In 1953, we were training Israeli Druze paratroopers to go in and do exactly this. This is a very old concept, and one we have to be aware of because it's extremely problematic to go in and try to aid minorities here. We've, I think, admirably abstained from any sort of involvement of this kind until now, and the challenge is to continue to do so. Secondly, the whole new periphery concept involving Cyprus and Greece is centered on gas. There are huge natural gas discoveries in the eastern Mediterranean. Israel is way ahead of its neighbors in exploiting them. We are already basically living off the natural gas from the Mediterranean. So there's a strong economic element here. And the obvious customer for natural gas is Turkey, because Turkey is also a transportation center for natural gas from Russia and the east to Europe. So the cheapest and most natural thing to do is link it up to Turkey. It makes sense for the Turks. It makes sense for us. There's only one problem, and his name is Erdogan. How this will work out, I don't know. But this is an area where we can, if we are smart enough to use proactive diplomacy where we can link up our new periphery with the Islamist core and do some good for everybody. Another area would be Egypt and the Nile waters. We have good relations with Egypt. We have excellent relations with Ethiopia. The only problem is, until very recently, we had a foreign minister who once liked to bluster and who threatened to drop an atomic bomb on the Aswan Dam. So this was not hardly a candidate to work with Egypt on a periphery core issue, but maybe that's possible in the future. Finally, Iran. And here I want to mention one important lesson from the periphery that I think very much applies, I believe, very much unfortunately, applies to American thinking on Iran today. I have an entire chapter on something called periphery nostalgia, and it applies particularly to Iran. There were many Israelis who, at the height of Trident, stopped thinking rationally and began to believe that this is the reunification of the ancient peoples of the Middle East who inhabited the region before the Arabs. The Jews are getting together with the Persians, getting together with the Turks, getting together with the descendants of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And this makes sense in a biblical sense. Now, our erstwhile periphery allies were totally cynical about these things, but there were people in Israel who really took it seriously. So we thought there was something almost God-given about the relationship with the Iranians. Along comes Khomeini, and these people, these nostalgic Israelis, choose to see him, and some to this day choose to see that regime as an aberration. These aren't the real Iranians. The real Iranians are our friends. They'll come back if we just give them a military push or deny them a nuclear weapon or continue the sanctions. The regime will fall. And the good guys will come back to power and the days of old will be restored. Well, I find absolutely no basis in rational analysis for this approach. But it's interesting to note that what seems to be emerging with the Obama administration's approach to Iran is to see a nuclear deal as a lever to, in effect, renew an Iranian-American strategic relationship and use Iran as a kind of pivot for U.S. policy in the region, because undeniably the Arab world is falling apart. And there's really, it's virtually impossible to find strategic partners there. And so we see General Dempsey telling Congress how helpful the Iranians are being here in Tikrit to win the battle against ISIS. And we see various aspects of coordination of airstrikes and the like via the Iraqis and the Syrians with the Iranians. If you paid attention to Netanyahu's speech, and you see I'm giving you the opening to ask the questions that you really want to ask. If you paid attention to Netanyahu's speech, there was lots of schmaltz in the beginning and schmaltz in the end, and a lot of unsubstantiated assertions about the nuclear dealings with Iran. But he did, and I'm glad he did say this is not just about nuclear. It's about Iran being the only state in the region that still calls for Israel's destruction, and it calls regularly for Israel's destruction. It's about Iran supporting terrorism, and it's about Iran on the ground in the Levant all the way up to our borders. All the way up to our borders. You may remember about a month ago, an Iranian general was killed just across the Golan border. He was reconnoitering an Iranian-led deployment of forces along our borders. And Netanyahu was correct to point out that this is a major aspect of not only our concerns about Iran, but those of our neighbors. And to say to the Obama administration, at least put this on the agenda of your talks with them. That's not going to happen. I'm quite aware that that's not going to happen. But if you like, I think we can learn something from, we can all learn something from our periphery experience in terms of the foibles of Iran nostalgia in the administration's approach to trying to bring Iran to a point where it somehow changes its skin and can be relied on, as in the days of the Shah, as the gendarme of American interests going back then. So on that happy note, I end my presentation and would welcome your questions.
Thank you, Yossi. That was an eye-opener for this listener, at least. I'm sure we'll have a bunch of questions and not a lot of time, but let's plow on here. Iran, the government of Iran, looks at the United States as the great Satan, but we keep hearing that the attitude among the public toward the United States is friendly. Might it be, now I'm going to sound like a periphery nostalgic here, might it be true as well of the public attitude toward Israel? Is it softer than the government's attitude?
The Iranian public attitude.
I
haven't seen what I would call reliable opinion surveys of the Iranian public on this issue. And my assumption is if you ask them, they'd be pretty hesitant to answer. I have to answer your question with a question. Go back to the era of the Shah, okay? We were cooperating with the Shah and his security services and some Iranian industrialists and generals. Did that reflect Iranian public opinion? I doubt it very much. Does the current Islamist regime reflect, on balance, a majority of Iranian public opinion? I think it does, quite frankly. I don't think it's an aberration. If you like, if anything, the Shah was an aberration. But neither regime is or was democratic, so that it's extremely difficult to come up with anything, any significant finding on this. When, on rare occasions, Israelis meet with Iranian academics at international conferences, since Rouhani came to power, some of the more moderate Western-trained academics would whisper in your ear, first we'll make up with the United States, then Israel's turn will come. We'll make up with Israel. But they're not speaking for the real regime. And the real regime is not Rouhani and Zarif. The real regime is Khamenei and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards. Mm-hmm. And they regularly, once a week or two, declare that we have to disappear. So where public opinion is on this, I don't know, and I'm not sure how relevant it is.
I'm taking this question because it's typed. What is your response to the statement from Iran's ambassador to the United Nations that Israeli aggression and the occupation of the Palestinian territories have always been a major propaganda value for extremist recruitment?
I think there's some truth to that. Yeah. I think there is some truth to that. I wouldn't go too far. I don't know, major value. It's interesting when you follow the propaganda of the militant Islamist movements. They don't begin by talking about Israel and Palestine. If you go back to 9/11, the first explanations given by Al-Qaeda were, we did this because there are American forces in Saudi Arabia. The U.S., if you'll note, pulled its forces out of Saudi Arabia. Only later did Al-Qaeda say, oh yes, we did this because of the Palestinian issue. As if some PR person said, you know, this is, you've got to put this in. You look at the same thing with the Islamic State today. We're not on their radar. If they're using us to recruit, you would see this on their websites and in their propaganda. We're not on their radar. On their radar are to get rid of the king of Saudi Arabia, to get rid of all the kings, and all the, just about everybody who's in the Arab world who are unacceptable to them from a pure Islamist standpoint. The only ones who put us at the top of their agenda and presumably use this for recruitment are Hezbollah, which is essentially a proxy of Iran, Shiites in southern Lebanon, and Iran itself. So this is a kind of self-serving statement in a way, although you can't deny that here and there, that does exist. I dare say, though, if tomorrow we make peace with the Palestinians and have a two-state solution, the Islamists will continue recruiting. And they'll continue recruiting, among other things, because they'll say that doesn't satisfy us. The Jews don't have a right to a sovereign existence on sacred Islamic territory, and therefore we continue the struggle.
This questioner asserts that Israel is widely reported to be cooperating with, if not supporting, jihadi al-Qaeda affiliate Shabat al-Nusra along the Golan. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. Okay. We go back to, I think it'll be easier with this, the minority picture. We're talking about this area here, right across the Israel-Syria-Golan border. What has happened in the years since the Syrian revolution broke out in 2011 is that a variety of revolutionary opposition groups grabbed territory, took it away from the Syrian army, which has essentially collapsed along our border, and also along the Jordanian border. There's a huge mix here. Jabhat al-Nusra, which you mentioned, is one of them, but there are also the remnants of the secular opposition, which is the ones that the U.S. initially set out to support but never really trained and gave weapons to, and they essentially frittered into nothing. But there are, if there are any remnants left, they're right here on our border. Now, at the same time, and this is the most recent development, and I mentioned that incident a month ago in which the Iranian general was killed. The Iranians, who are essentially commanding the Syrian army today, and using their Shiite allies in southern Lebanon, Hezbollah, as the kind of commando force of, but also all kinds of, I mean, there's a whole foreign legion of Shiite volunteers from Pakistan and Afghanistan and all over the place under Iranian command. The Iranians, Hezbollah controls the Lebanese border with Israel. The Iranians are now trying to turn the corner and take control of the Golan border with Syria as well, ostensibly on behalf of Syria. Now, Israel, a couple of years ago, Israel's initial approach was hands off. We're not going to get involved. It's impossible to find the good guys here. They're all bad. They're all either Islamic fanatics or they're Assad, who gasses his own people and murders them by the hundreds of thousands. And as you can imagine, we have a special sensitivity to people gassing civilians right across the border. So we're not going to get involved. But we eventually found ourselves giving humanitarian aid to this collection of opposition groups, including Jabhat al-Nusra, medical aid. They come to Israel, they get treated, they go back, blankets in winter, and so on and so forth. And yes, obviously here and there that is morphed into some kind of intelligence cooperation, which involves Jordan as well, and the United States, which if it's training Syrian opposition anywhere, it's here in Jordan. It puts the U.S. in a very interesting position because, as I said, it's getting cozy with Iran at the same time that it is purporting to work against the Syrian regime by helping these guys. So there has been some cooperation. What appears to be emerging in Israeli strategic thinking, judging by that incident with the Iranian general, is that if we have to pick a side, we're going to pick the Sunni Islamists. We're going to pick the Sunni Islamists because we're not on their radar. That doesn't mean they love us. And it doesn't mean that if in one day they're in power in Damascus, they won't want to make war against us. But right now, they don't want to mess with us. And they welcome any aid. Whereas Iran wants to mess with us. Iran wants to sit here and wrap itself around these borders and instigate, based on its own ideology, instigate aggression against Israel. So if you have to choose which one to oppose and which one to work with, The choice is fairly obvious, but having said that, I repeat, since the fiasco with the Maronites, you will not see Israeli boots. I would be very surprised to see Israeli boots on the ground on Syrian soil or Lebanese soil in the context of this struggle.
Encouraging. Thank you, Yossi.